years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. Bit grey today, isn't it?
Well, hello. Good afternoon. It's the Deepest Lore. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here. Now, we're interrupting our little Andy Warhol kind of detour because Dee is unwell. And in fact, we're not going to be able to do next week either because I have to go back to visit my parents. So I'll be doing something else next week as well. I thought I might do something a bit different today, looking at pop culture and specifically the music scene in the 1960s. Just let people trickle in here. Had a nice day today. Got up bright and early with a little one. Watched a little bit of Button Moon. We took Mrs. AA and the little one to breakfast. Put the finishing touches to my speech and finalised my slides and things for tomorrow, because the event is on, obviously, tomorrow. Had my beard done at the Turks. I wanted to make sure my beard was looking nice for the event. What else? Bought AAA a nice wooden bus toy, because AAA is into buses at the moment. And I couldn't resist buying this. So in many ways, living my best life, friends, living my best life, posting base stuff on Telegram, probably stuff that's too based for most, but I don't care. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. All right, so yes, why don't we get going? Now, I don't have much more than a kind of starting point for this discussion today. Let's see where it takes us. I've picked out some songs that I thought we'd have a look at the lyrics together. I become quite interested. There's this guy on Twitter called Max who started getting me thinking along these lines. But he mentioned basically that hold on, give me one second. Yes, he mentioned that the 1960s counterculture. Hold on, sorry. What's going on? Yeah, I print it. I'm printing it.
Okay, so that's
my space speech for tomorrow. Okay, I've got my coffee. I'm doing my show, so I'm on air right now.
Yes, I know. Well, you look amused, so I thought that
would just start. Look, it's done the pictures as well.
Great, excellent.
All right, see you later. Okay, so sorry about that. Okay, well, so let's start again. Now, the subject for today's show is there was this guy on Twitter called Max, got me thinking. He was basically like, have you ever considered that the 1960s in Britain and the 1960s in America were two very different beasts? And that the British Invasion Act, you know, the Beatles, the Kinks, Rolling Stones, the British so-called counterculture, the swinging 60s in London, actually was a very, very, very different beast from what was happening in America, from the civil rights stuff in the early 60s right through to, you know, the San Francisco, the drugs, the student riots in 1968, and Stonewall in 1969. And it really got me thinking that if you took the 1960s and you just deleted the American acts, let's just pretend the American acts don't exist. I think the 1960s would start to look extremely different, both in terms of the subject matter of what the acts tended to talk about, but also how we would process the 1960s in terms of this kind of epistemic rupture, massive, you know, moment where, you know, it's seen as this break with the past. Because I think, I don't know what the hell's happening with my speech. It's basically the printer is just splashing it all over the floor. Oh, God. I haven't numbered the pages either. It's going to be a pain. So anyway, Gordon Bennett, hold on a second. Sorry. What the fuck is going on with this? We're out of paper, sir. I need you to put paper in there. There's no paper there.
Great timing.
More paper for you. I need more paper in there. Okay. Sorry. So now we need to carry on here. So I wanna just start by taking into consideration some of the key songs from the American side of things. We're just gonna have a quick skim through them to get a feel for what was going on in America and the general tone of what's happening there. And then I want to then switch in the second half of the stream to think about what's happening in Britain, how different it feels, and what that really means in terms of the culture.
You're being quite the diva. I didn't turn this on during your stream. You did.
Yeah, but
nothing to do with me. I'm helping you here.
Okay.
Yeah, you should say thank you.
All right, thanks. Yeah.
You don't come across very well.
Cheers. All right. Thanks. Thank you. I've got to do my show.
Welcome.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Right. Now then. Oh, bloody hell. Right. Okay. Now then. Yes. First of all, we have to think about, before I even start looking at the songs, some of the different contexts coming into the 1960s. Okay, so in America, the 1950s was a kind of a high for them. They'd won the war. They were enjoying the kind of prosperity that came from the Marshall Plan and the various different loans they were giving to rebuild Europe after the war. They had become the world hegemon after the Suez Crisis in 1958. It's still a time that it's looked on with nostalgia in the American context as a kind of high point. And a lot of the GIs, the GI generation as they were known, came back from the war victorious, and they filled, they occupied a lot of the managerial positions. They basically kind of took over the establishment, and they were army men, obviously. They'd all be in the army. They were pretty regimented in their ways. They were quite conservative. There was a drive to get women back in the kitchen in the 1950s. So the 1950s came with it a kind of conformism and a kind of conformist conservative culture in the 1950s, which you can all picture. Okay, some people you might say romanticize that era. Some people have, you know, I've talked before about how it wasn't, you know, many aspects of it were artificial. But the fact of the matter is that the 1950s were actually a good time. It was safe. They were prosperous. Many people's living standards improved and all the rest of it. Now, in the 1960s, what happened is that the generation of kids, the boomers, as we call them, who were born during the war and a little bit afterwards to the GI generation, started to come of age, and they, of course, had not been part of the war, They hadn't been to the army, and they hadn't known any world other than this lovely, safe world that the GIs built them in the 1950s, you know, barbecues with the family in the garden, you know, living in the suburbs, the 2.4 family, kind of wholesome, but you might say a little bit stifling if you're an individual in that time, because as I keep on mentioning, it was quite a conformist culture. So a lot of the counterculture in the 1960s in America was all about breaking through and overturning that 1950s G.I. Joe type culture that had come after winning the war. Now, you could see this in many different ways. Part of it, there's an element of it right the way through, is a kind of North versus South thing, especially the kind of educated cosmopolitan class from New York and from LA, you know, the two coastal elites, I guess you'd call them, who you know, they tended towards being liberal. They you know, heavy in indexing of Jewish families in those areas. They had you know, they had certain ideas about the world. You know, they were left wing, they were idealistic, and so on and so forth. And then, I mean, it's much the same split that you have in America today. And then you had the Bible Belt, conservative, tended to have more old-fashioned views on things like race, gender, sexuality, blah, blah, blah. And as we'll see, the attack vectors in the 1960s, right from the civil rights movement onwards, were along these lines. There was a very strong racial aspect, whereby the coastal elites had this idea that the rest of the country were racist, that they needed to desegregate, that it was time for the black man to rise up and all this sort of thing. And of course, there was an alliance between these coastal elites, many of them Jews, as I mentioned. I don't mention this out of any kind of... this is just a fact. I mean, you can just see the names of the people who were involved with these movements, to see that, you know, a lot of them were from these kind of, especially the New York crowd. They were just from that community, but they made an alliance with the black community, and especially black artists of this time, as we'll see. And this comes through very strongly in the music as well, and in the general culture. So that's one vector, is it's time for you know, black people to reach parity with white people in America, and it's time to overthrow the bigotry and the prejudice of the past. Okay, another attack vector in the 1960s in America was what was called women's liberation. Now, the feminism wasn't as, how can I say, militant at that time. It had a kind of different flavor, whereby it was much more about how women shouldn't be confined to just being this kind of quiet housewife. Women had their own views as well. One of those things was that women had sexuality. Women, the same as men, should be free to express themselves in all ways, including sexually. So a lot of the push in America was for women to see themselves as sexual beings. And as again, we'll see this comes through in some of the music. And then a little bit later on in the decade, you had the advent of Stonewall in 1969. You have a kind of an increased pushing of the boundaries when it came to what would traditionally be regarded as sexual deviance. So there's a sex element as well. And cutting across all of these vectors, so that the race, the gender, and the sexuality in America, you also have the issue of drugs and drug culture. That is part of this whole scene. Now, as we have a look over in Britain, okay, so that's the American scene coming out of World War II and into the 60s, and what the countercultural scene is there, okay. But in Britain, the experience was different. For one, even though Britain is said to have won World War II, it was very, very hard on the country. They didn't come out of World War II with this kind of prosperity bounce like the Americans did. They came out of it in debt. Lots and lots of men had died and given their lives. Famously, there was rationing. So the 1950s were a time of austerity, kind of time where people were struggling. There was still some of that war spirit to help people kind of come together, but it was a very different atmosphere. And in the 1950s in Britain, rather than America, there was already a kind of counterculture that came out of the theatres more than anything else, known as the Angry Young Men. I've mentioned this before. John Osborne, he wrote a play called Look Back in Anger. There was Arnold Wesco, who's a bit more of a kind of class warrior. There were various different people. There's that one that Jonathan Bowden talks about. I forget his name now. But there were a group of men who were known as Angry Young Men in the mid-1950s. And these characters actually were still around in the 1960s. In fact, on the cover of this show, I've got Michael Caine. I think it's a shot from Alfie, is it? And John Osborne actually crops up in Michael Caine, in a couple of Michael Caine movies. I think he's in The Italian Job. I need to just double check which movie John Osborne crops up in, but he's like one of the it's Get Carter. Yeah, so if you watch Get Carter, John Osborne actually crops up, the playwright, in that. So these 1950s Angry Young Men were still around in the 1960s, and in fact a lot of the let's say the 60s generation were aware of the Angry Young Men, as they were kind of a influence in the background. Now, what were the Angry Young Men of the 1950s angry about? Well, if you watch that play, Look Back in Anger, or The Entertainer by Osborne, or various other works from the Angry Young Men, you'll see that an overriding concern is with Britain's loss of position in the world, the loss of empire, the cost of World War II, the fact that there was rife unemployment in the 1950s in Britain, and this general sense that for that generation of men, the generation that had just missed out on fighting in the war, they were just a bit too young to fight in the war. So they were coming of age, they were in their, say, early 20s in, let's say, 1955, 1956. For that generation of young men, they felt that they'd been robbed of anything to fight for. They'd been robbed of a kind of life prospects because there was no work around. They were promised a lot of things by the Clement Attlee government after the war, which obviously didn't come to fruition. You know, they were told all sorts of things, promised the moon on a stick, you might say, but they didn't come to pass. And so by the mid-50s, it was very obvious that this kind of bright new dawn wasn't really happening. And life was actually quite miserable in the mid-50s there. So these young men were angry about all of that. There was also immigration was part of it as well. They'd started to allow people to come in from the Commonwealth at this time. That's something that the angry young men were angry about. So there was a lot of things that typical youngster in Britain was pretty pissed off about. And this fed into, I guess you might call, the rocker culture of that time. I mean, it's documented in a film like Brighton Rock to some extent, which was like a little bit earlier, 1948. You know, the rockers, they tended to dress a bit like Marlon Brando in The Wild One. You know, they were on motorbikes, they wore black leathers, kind of teddy boy haircuts. And, you know, a part of it was that they were kind of pissed off that their heritage was being eroded in a way, and what it meant to be British in the world, but also within Britain, was starting to slip. Now, I guess a substrain of that anger was this general feeling of American encroachment on British identity. I guess you'd call it cultural imperialism. But it's this sense that this commercial, soulless, materialistic, plastic American culture was starting to come over here. And it was kind of horrible, and it was kind of ruthless. And it was, an affront to what it meant to be British, I guess. So already, in the way that I'm panning this out, I'm sure you can see that, how can I put this? The natural sensibilities of the American counterculture in the 60s, I would say, kind of swung left. It was a leftist rebellion against a conservative war generation in America. Whereas in Britain, it was much more a kind of, I would say, romantic or even borderline reactionary response to a kind of readjustment for Britain in global affairs. And I guess you could say a kind of revulsion against modernity itself. So these are some themes I want you to bear in mind when I'm going through this. Now, to make matters more confusing for us, obviously, because this was a time of globalization as well, British acts went over to America. American acts came over here. American acts would be friends with British acts. Certain British acts would pick up American themes. Certain American acts would pick up British themes. So there was, I'm not saying that these two different strains of the 1960s were entirely unrelated, or that you couldn't get a British act who was sympathetic to, let's say, I don't know, race, gender, feminism. Okay. I'm just saying that if I was to make some broad generalizations about what was animating these two generations of countercultures, I guess you'd say, I would say that the animating spirit in America and the animating spirit in Britain was different. For a start, I don't think the kind of ethnic elements, the Jewish and black influences, were as marked in Britain as they were in America. There's no doubt about that. And that's just a demographic reality. I also think that on the British side of things, class is always going to be a factor, just because it's a much more class conscious society. So as we'll see, there are some class elements that are registered in it. Although, again, I think there's this tendency to always want to paint things from this era as being quote unquote radical. Okay. But I don't believe that most of the big acts from the British invasion were kind of radicals or revolutionaries in that way. it's not like these are Marxist critiques of, you know, the old aristocracy or something. As we'll see, they critiqued all sides of life, including the working class. What we get from a lot of the British acts are these kind of like vignettes of different sides of British life. And they're vignettes that are often done in a loving way. They're highlighting, you know, there's some social comment, they're highlighting some issues perhaps with the culture, but they're not kind of standing there with placards and saying we must overthrow this. Whereas in America, as we'll see in a moment, I think there's that kind of capital R revolution in the air a little bit more. So with all of that preamble said, let's get into looking at some specifics. I do have the entropy open, which I'll slip in there into the chat. And let me now share some lyrics. Hopefully it will let me do this. Okay. So we're going to start. in America. In fact, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll share my entire screen. We're not going to be able to listen to any of these songs if you're unfamiliar with them, as I'm sure some of you. I mean, the more cultured of you, the AA radio fans, I'm sure will know every single one of these songs. So they've picked very famous songs. But if you're one of these kind of disgusting Zoomers whose idea of culture is watching a couple of Japanese cartoons and wanking into a sock, you can look at, I would encourage you to listen to these songs in your own time if you're unfamiliar with them, because you really should, you know, start to educate yourself on these sorts of matters. But anyway, let us have a look now at some, I'm going to look at some American songs first to try to underline and draw out some kind of textual evidence for the claims I've made already. Okay. Now we're going to start with Bob Dylan. If you watched my old Bob Dylan part one and part two, part three is still going to come. I will do it. Maybe I'll do that next week. We'll see. You'll know that Bob Dylan kind of turned his back on the whole protest movement. And after about 1960, late 1964, 1965, Bob Dylan is no longer really part of this set. However, when he started his career in the early 60s, he was very much part of this kind of, he was associated with this civil rights thing. And in some of his worst moments, in my view, he kind of registers what is, you know, what it meant to be part of that kind of left-wing scene. Here is a song called Talking John Birch Paranoid Blues. If you know anything about the John Birch Society, they were kind of a conservative society, I guess. People like Russell Kirk used to write for them. And naturally, at this time, they were very much animated by something called the Red Scare. They thought a lot of, you know, there were a lot of Reds under the bed. And this was parodied and made fun of by the, you know, leftist intellectuals at the time, and by the media and the, you know, likes of Bob Dylan here, because they thought it was just kind of paranoid, you know, John Birch paranoid blues. My own view is that almost every single conservative moral panic, including the satanic panic in the 1980s, was 100% justified. And if anything, they didn't go far enough. We now know, for example, that they definitely were Reds under the bed in the 1950s and in the 1960s. Communists were infiltrating America at all levels. And boy, are we now paying the price. However, that was not, you know, the response of the left of that time was to make fun of these claims. And here's Bob Dylan doing just that in Talking John Birch Paranoid Blues. He says, "While I was feeling sad and blue, I didn't know what in the world I was going to do. The communists, they was coming round. They was in the air. They was on the ground. They wouldn't give me no peace. So I run down most hurriedly and I joined up the John Birch Society. I got me a secret membership card and started a walking down the road. Yee-hoo, I'm a real John Bircher now. Look out, you commies. And all of this was really funny, you know, to his leftist audience when he was, bear in mind, this is very young Bob Dylan. So, you know, he does grow out of this rubbish. But now we all agree with Hitler's views, although he killed 6 million Jews. It doesn't matter too much that he was a fascist. At least you can't say he was a communist. That's to say, like, if you got a cold and you had to take a shot of malaria. Well, I was looking everywhere for the gold down reds. I got up in the morning and looked under my bed, looked in the sink behind the door, looked in the glove department of my car, couldn't find them. And you could get, you know, the whole song. He's kind of looking everywhere, looks in the chimney hole, looks down the toilet. He's basically looking for commies everywhere and he can't find them. Ha ha, look at those stupid conservatives. So this is like a typical, you know, protest song of the early era. And, you know, Dylan was part of that scene. So you can see already that in the American setting, there, on top of the all of the other narratives, there's also this kind of heavy anti-conservative bent, a heavy kind of political, you know, they're on one side of this. And those stupid, paranoid John Birchers, who are basically quasi-fascists, you know, they're just stupid because they're looking for commies everywhere. And, you know, this is a moral panic. Of course, these commies don't exist. The irony is, of course, is that probably half of Bob Dylan's audience watching this were card-carrying communists at the time. So that's one example of the rather overtly political bent of the 60s in America. Okay, here's another example, more famous one from Dylan. The times, they are a-changing. Come gather around people wherever you roam and admit that the waters around you have grown and accept that soon you'll be drenched to the bone if your time to worth you is worth saving. Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times, they are changing. Notice there's a kind of threat. There's an implicit threat in these lyrics. You better start swimming, otherwise you're going to sink. He's talking about conservative Christian Americans with traditional views, okay? Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. Don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. There's no telling who it is naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are changing. Come senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway. Don't block up the hall. Now, again, reading between the lines, obviously this is Dylan, so he's always cryptic, but I would say he's probably talking about those senators and congressmen from the South who were backing institutions that were trying to maintain segregation during this time. There was a lot of protest in this early 60s era trying to stop, for example, black students going to white universities and things like this. Don't block up the hall. You know, he's probably talking about James Meredith there. Again, I don't know for sure. I'm just guessing, but it seems like he's talking about these sorts of scenes. But he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled the battle outside raging. Will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing. You know, listen, there's a fight going on, and you're not going to be able to withstand this. Basically, those black guys are going to be coming to your school or university near you, and there's nothing that you can do. For fathers and mothers throughout the land, don't criticize what you can't understand. The sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. So please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand, for the times they are changing. Basically, the older generation have got to get out of the way if they're not up for the stuff that their sons and daughters are up to. And again, the battle lines are race, gender, sexuality. Again, he's not stating it, but this is what's in the background. You know, you've got to remember the context of where Dylan would be playing these songs. You know, he played at the famous March on Washington in 1963 when Martin Luther King, you know, gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, you know, in these same moments, Dylan was there playing this song, you know. So, you know, these are live political charges that are registered in this music. The line, it is drawn, the curse, it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are changing. And again, if you think about the context, you know, let's pretend he's talking about whites in America. Whites were first then in 1961. Later they'll be last. Now in 2021, they are last. The order did rapidly fade. Everything he said here came to pass here. Notice it is a revolutionary tone, which is not accepting no for an answer. This is very defiant, this song. It's saying, it's like a flood coming through. You're not going to be able to stop it. You know, the old order is going to be turned upside down. So you can either get on board or you can be swept aside like the kind of dustbin of history. You're going to be left behind. So this is another famous Dylan protest song of this early 60s period. Now let's hit some other key moments in the American version of the 1960s. Here's Sam Cooke. A change is going to come. Let's have a look at the lyrics. I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is going to come. Yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die because I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is going to come. Yes, it will. I go to the movie. I go downtown. Somebody keeps telling me, don't hang around. Now, bear in mind, this is a black man in 1964. You know what he's talking about. He's trying to see a movie. He's obviously gone to a cinema, which is like a white cinema. And there are going to be people saying, you're not allowed in here, mate, because you're the wrong color. It's been a long time coming, but you know a change going to come. Yes, it will. And I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Lord, there being time that I thought I couldn't last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change going to come. So again, obviously, in the context of 1964 America, this was a civil rights song, and it was about a black, it's the black man's time in America now. You're not going to be able to not keep me down on my knees anymore. It's time to give us a chance. Change is going to come. You're not going to segregate against us anymore. We're going to have the same rights as you from this moment onwards. And note again the revolutionary notes in this. I'd be interested to see who the producers were on this record and who owned the record label. The names, you know, you can do a check on those names yourself. That's A Change Gonna Come by Sam Cooke. And again, you can see continuity with what Dylan was talking about. This is a kind of heavily political movement in America. Let's carry on. James Brown. This is from 1968, time of civil strife in America and around the world. You had the May 68 riots in France. They carried over. There were massive Vietnam protests that year. James Brown. Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. With your bad self. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Some people say we've got a lot of malice. Some say it's a lot of nerve. But I say we won't quit moving until we get what we deserve. We've been buked and we've been scorned. We've been treated bad, talked about as sure you're born. But just as sure as it takes two eyes to make a pair, ha, brother, we can't quit until we get our share. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. I worked on jobs with my feet in my hands. but all the work I did was for the other man. The other he means by the for the white man. Now we demand a chance to do things for ourselves. We're tired of beating our head against the wall and working for someone else. Say it loud and black and I'm proud. Ooh wee, give it to me. All right, you're out of sight. All night so tough. You're tough and rough. Ooh wee, you're killing me. Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. We demand a chance to do things for ourselves. We're tired of beating our heads against the wall, working for someone else. We're people. We like the birds and the bees. We'd rather die on our feet than be living on our knees. Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. And again, there's not too much ambiguity in these lyrics. It's obvious what James Brown is talking about here. The racial themes are front and center. They cannot be ignored. These are black people saying, it's our time now. You've got to give us a chance, white man. And we're here. And now the law's behind us too. I'm black and I'm proud. Let's keep on going. These are all things that were in the cultural ether of the 1960s in America. Aretha Franklin singing Otis Redding's Respect. Now, really, the lyrics of this don't say much. She just says, what you want, baby, I got it. What do you need? Do you know I got it? Then the chorus. All I'm asking for is a little respect when you come home. Just a little bit, baby. Then, you know, famously, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Take care, T-C-B. Oh, well. Sock it to me, blah, blah, blah. So now, what's the significance? Why have I chosen this song by Aretha Franklin as a representative of what was in the air in the 1960s? So we've already had the black empowerment narratives that we've registered. What's the difference here? This is a black woman specifically saying, listen, respect, you've got to respect me. Got to respect me. And it makes a difference that it's Aretha Franklin saying it, not Otis Redding. This was the iconic version of this song. And again, these are themes of, I mean, even here, groundbreaking female empowerment anthem of the late 1960s. So now this is not just blacks versus whites. It's women versus men, and even black women versus black men. If you want to take it that far, you know, there's when it comes to a lot of these 60s singers like Aretha Franklin, there's always the kind of specter, I guess, of domestic abuse lurking in the background of these songs. You know, you think of Ike and Tina Turner or various other examples. There's this idea that now I'm going to be treated with respect, damn it, whether you like it or not, because I'm a woman. Let's carry on. So these are all the kind of big empowerment themes. But like I said, there was more going on in the 1960s in America. So let's think about some of the kind of New York underground scenes. What about the drugs? Here's the Velvet Underground, heroin. I don't know just where I'm going, but I'm going to try for the kingdom if I can, because it makes me feel like I'm a man when I put a spike into my vein. And I tell you, things just aren't quite the same when I'm rushing on my run and I just feel like Jesus' son. And I guess that I just don't know. I've made a big decision. I'm going to try to nullify my life, because when the blood begins to flow, when it shoots up the dropper's neck, when I'm closing in on death, you can't help me, not you guys, or all you sweet girls with your sweet talk. You can all go and take a walk. And I guess that I just don't know. And I guess that I just don't know. I wish that I'd been born 1,000 years ago. I wish that I'd sailed the darkened seas on the great big clipper ship, going from this land here to that, on a sailor's suit and cap, away from the big city, where a man cannot be free of all the evils of this town and of himself and those around. Oh, and I guess that I just don't know. Heroin be the death of me. Heroin, it's my wife and it's my life, aha. Because a main line into my vein is the centre of my head, and that I'm better off dead. Because when the smack begins to flow, I really don't care anymore about all the Jim-Jims in this town and all the politics making crazy sounds and everybody putting everybody else down and all the dead bodies piled up in mounds. Because when the smack begins to flow and I don't really care anymore, ah, when that heroin is in my blood, huh, and that is blood in my head, then thank God I'm as good as dead. Thank your God that I am not aware. And thank God that I just don't care. And I guess I just don't know. Oh, I guess I just don't know. So this is the kind of the flip side of the 60s scene, I guess. There's the kind of, you know, big fist, yay, black rights, women's rights, gay rights side of the 60s. And then there's this dark undercurrent of nihilism and drugs and escapism and hedonism and this kind of sense that nothing matters anymore in this godless materialist world. And obviously this is registered on songs by the Velvet Underground. This is Heroin. And another kind of seedy song from the Velvets, Velvet Underground, and Nico, of course, is Velvet in Furs. And again, this is a song about S&M, but it's not a kind of sexuality empowerment song. It's more just a kind of darker side of life type song, okay? And again, this in its own way is deeply subversive to the, you know, the moral framework of most normal working Americans at this time. But let's just see. Here are the lyrics of Venus in Furs. Shiny, shiny, shiny boots of leather, whiplash girl child in the dark. Come in bells, your servant, don't forsake him. Strike, dear mistress, and curious heart. Downy sins of streetlight fancies, chase the costume she shall wear. Ermine furs adored, imperious, Severin awaits you there. I am tired, I am weary. I could sleep for 1,000 years, 1,000 dreams that could awake me, different colours made of tears. Kiss the boot of shiny, shiny leather in the dark, tongue of thongs, the belt that does await you. Strike, dear mistress, the cure is his heart. Severin, speak so lightly. Severin, down on your bended knee, taste the whip in love, not given lightly. Taste the whip, now bleed for me. I am tired, I am weary, I could sleep for 1,000 years, 1,000 dreams that could awake me, different colours made of tears. Shiny, shiny boots of leather, whiplash girl child in the dark. Severin, your servant, comes in bells. Please don't forsake me. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart. So you can see there, this is a kind of pretty strong sadomasochistic song which doesn't pull any punches. And again, there's this, how can I say, like full-throated embrace of the darker side of life. You know, so the American 60s, I would say, has this political side, but it also has this like dark edge that you get registered in the Velvets and some of the crazier psychedelic acts on the West Coast as well. Again, I would say most of these elements are missing when we come to the British scene, which we'll have a look at in a moment. And sticking with the kind of the drugs and the darker side of things, here's White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane. One pill makes you larger and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. Obviously, there's a strong references to Alice in Wonderland, but obviously this is talking about you know, hallucinogens and LSD and things like that. If you go chasing rabbits and you know you're going to fall, tell them a hookah smoking caterpillar has given you the call. Call Alice when she was just small. Then the men on the chessboard get up and tell you where to go, and you've just had some kind of mushroom and your mind is moving low. Go ask Alice. I think she'll know. When logic and proportion have fallen sloppy dead and the white knight is talking backwards and the red queen's off her head, remember that what the Dormouse said, feed your head, feed your head. And again, I mean, this is a magnificent, famous song, of course, from 1967, from Surrealistic Pillow. Again, if you've lived in a rock your entire life and you don't know the song, I would encourage you to check it out. But you can see, especially when you listen to this record, yes, they're talking about the experience of taking hallucinogens, but it's dark. You know, it's not like unironic kind of glorification of drug culture. It's doing it with the knowledge that there's something a little bit kind of sinister about all of this as well. Like I said, this is the darker side of the American 60s culture. I think I'm going to finish off my look at the American side of things with another song from 1968, For What It's Worth by Buffalo Springfield. I think possibly more than any other song, this gets at the political side of things. You know, again, talking about various protests, Vietnam, all the rest of it. So here's Buffalo Springfield. There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down? There's battle lines being drawn, and nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down? And I think that's the reference to when that student was shot, you know, in the Vietnam protest. You know, stop. What's that sound? It's the gunshot of the protester being shot by the American forces. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street singing songs and are carrying signs, mostly saying hooray for our side. It's time we stopped. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down? Paranoia strikes deep into your life. It will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line. The man will come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down, etc. So again, I mean, this song, when you look at it, they're probably starting to say, Buffalo Springfield, maybe it's time to like think about where we're headed here, because there are two sides on this collision course. Battle lines are being drawn. Nobody's giving any way here. Where is this going to head? And I know, in a way, America has never stopped. America has never stopped the culture war from this time onwards. You know, back then it was John Birch and the hippies. Now, of course, it's the wokesters and you know, the MAGA hats or whatever. But these forces have never stopped ever since the 60s, and possibly beforehand as well. So you can see that the American picture has a enduring set of concerns from the start of the 60s right the way through to the end of the 60s, and they haven't really gone away. They've almost like set the agenda for the next like 50 years. Literally, I mean, so look, 1970, 30, yeah, 50 years. I mean, more than 50 years now. So a lot of the battles are still the same. If you ask me, only the left have ever won. The left probably see things differently. But, you know, that is the scene in America. Now, I want to move now to have a look at the how different the feel of the British artists are, okay, when compared with all of this, okay? Let's just have a look at the Beatles. There are no more iconic 60s acts in Britain or America than the Beatles, okay? But obviously the Beatles were British. Forget John Lennon's Imagine and what you know, the love and Yoko Ono for a second. Let's just look at what they were saying here in 1967. Bear in mind, in America, Buffalo Springfield are basically talking about a society tearing itself apart. This is what the Beatles were talking about in the same year, okay? I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And then the news was rather sad. Well, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the streets had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was from the House of Lords. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away. But I just had to look, having read the book. And again, I mean, you can read all of these lyrics on multiple levels, but we're already thinking in terms of the English army. We're probably thinking of World War II. You know, I don't know if Lennon's probably thinking about what's that film he was in? The Second World War or My Part in It. Remember he was in that film? But the book could also be the Bible, of course. You know, lyrics can be cryptic. He says, I'd love to turn you on. So this is the Lennon part of the song. And then famously, McCartney comes in, you know, woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head, found my way downstairs and drank a cup. Looking up, I noticed I was late, found my coat and grabbed my hat, made the bus in seconds flat, found my way upstairs and had a smoke. Somebody spoke and I went into a dream. I read the news today, oh boy, 4,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. And though the holes were rather small, they had to count them all. And now I know how many holes it takes to fill the Albert Hall. I'd love to turn you on. So already we can see, okay, that in the American context, there's always sides. It's always political. It's always, you know, us versus them, the old versus the young, the, you know, the blacks versus the whites, the women versus the men. The battle lines are being drawn. Here, whatever's going on when it comes to the Beatles, they feel, at the very least, as if they're rooted in British culture already. They're not rebelling against the old people who fought who just won the war, for example. They're not having a go at the older generation in the same way. You know, he's getting on, Paul McCartney's literally getting on the bus with everybody else. And you get the sense of a group of people who are still rooted in a time and a place in Blackburn in Lancashire. You know, they're getting on the bus. It's obviously a British bus. You know, they're talking about the English army. They're talking about the House of Lords. You don't get this. How can I say that? There's a sense of continuity with the past already in a song like A Day in the Life. And if you listen to this song, the way it's sung, the way it's performed, the kind of slight haunting quality of the vocals on this, it kind of sounds nostalgic. I don't know what they're nostalgic for, but it sounds like you're going on a journey with them back through time as well as forward through time, and that we're all in it together. This is very different from what we were seeing in America just now. It's just a different world. I don't know. I mean, let me see in the chat to see if people agree or disagree. Am I talking about nonsense here? Am I talking about nonsense? Let's have a look. I mean, what is the us versus them here? Who's the them? I don't even see the fight. What's the fight even when it comes to A Day in the Life? So, and even with their choice of having a full-blown orchestra on this, there's even a kind of musical bridge back past beyond rock to kind of classical civilization in a strange way. I know this sounds, you know, could sound wanky, but when you listen to A Day in the Life, you can hear the echoes of old British culture and you can hear the echoes of a wider European culture in a way that is just impossible if you're listening to something like, you know, I'm Black and I'm Proud by James Brown, because it's just not there. Whereas it's all there in a song like A Day in the Life. Okay, let's carry on. Maybe I'm not selling people, but here's Eleanor Rigby, 1966. Ah, oh, look at all those lonely people. Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where the wedding has been, lives in the window, waits at the window. Let me just put my ad blocker on here to stop that annoying thing coming. Okay. Waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who's it for? All the lonely people, where do they come from? All the lonely people, where do they belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near. Look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they come from? Look at all the lonely people. Eleanor Rigby died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came. Father Mackenzie, wiping the dirt from his hands as he walks from the grave, no one was saved. All the lonely people, where do they come from? Now again, these Eleanor Rigby is obviously not from the same generation as the Beatles. This is obviously an old lonely woman from a different generation. And Father Mackenzie, you're guessing, is also not part of their generation. And again, I don't believe that on a track like this, the Beatles are looking at Eleanor Rigby or Father Mackenzie with contempt. They're looking at them with empathy and compassion, and there's a continuity there. And yes, okay, they didn't go to the funeral, but they are choosing to immortalize the idea of these people in their song. So there's a continuity. Nobody turned up to this woman's wedding. Nobody turns up to this woman's funeral, but they have decided to immortalize that funeral in a song on their classic album, Revolver, to the point where people are still listening to this song today. So in a strange way, the Beatles are using their song about loneliness, Eleanor Rigby, in a strange way to right the wrongs of the fact that nobody turned up to this woman's funeral. And again, you could disagree. I don't get an us versus them theme. I don't get that this is political revolution. I don't get that this is a group of young men who are just angry at their country and want to overturn all its institutions. This seems to be a song that's rooted in a time and a place, and that has a kind of residual love for the people of that time and place, even if they're lonely. So let's continue. So here's In My Life from Rubber Soul, 1965. Again, if you listen to the song, deeply nostalgic themes in the music. Just the music alone is evocative, and it makes you feel like you're remembering something. You're looking, that very much the attitude is looking backwards, not punching up with a fist in the air, pointing forwards. We're going to overturn, you know, a change has come in. You know, the times they are changing, move over, old man. This is all looking backwards all the time with a kind of fondness and love for the country. Here's In My Life. There are places I'll remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All those places had their moments. With lovers and friends, I still can recall. Some are dead and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all. And you see, even with a line like "some are dead and some are living," probably Lennon and McCartney have no idea that they were doing this, but they're evoking the Burkean social contract. You know, those who have died, those who are living, those are yet to be born. There's a sense of continuity with the past, the present, and the future. And they're coming at this from now, but they're not trying to kill the past. They're not trying to condemn the past. They had their moment. These places had their moments. But there are all these friends and lovers. There's no one compares with you. And these memories lose their meaning when I think of love as something new. Though I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before. I know I'll often stop and think about them in my life. I love you more. And then repeat, in my life, I love you more. So, yeah, it's a love song. And he's saying, like, you know, obviously the whoever's addressed to, I love you more than those things. But they make a point of saying, I'll never lose affection for the people and things that went before. This is not a revolutionary message. It's not. It's a message that says the past matters. It gives us meaning in our lives. You can't just condemn the past because it's part of us. This is a very different inflection from the stuff that we were looking at from America. I think you'd agree. Okay, now I've just picked out one song from the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones are a slightly different kettle of fish when it comes to this, because most of their music doesn't touch on social themes at all. But let's just bear something like Aretha Franklin's Respect when we come to look at a song like this, because I think the Jagger Richards songs, especially on Aftermath, are laced with just old-fashioned misogyny. I mean, let's just look at this. I don't think this is a feminist anthem in any single way. Here's Rolling Stones. Under my thumb, the girl who once had me down. Under my thumb, the girl who once pushed me around. It's down to me. The difference in the clothes she wears, down to me. The change has come. She's under my thumb. Ain't it the truth, babe? Under my thumb, the squirming dog who's just had her day. Under my thumb, a girl who just changed her ways. It's down to me, yes. The way she does just what she's told, it's down to me. The change has come. She's under my thumb. Under my thumb is a Siamese cat of a girl. Under my thumb, she's the sweetest pet in the world. It's down to me. The way she walks when she talks, when she's spoken to. Down to me. The change has come. She's under my thumb. Now, okay, there's probably a way of reading this song to say, well, is this Jagger and Richards making some sort of comment about, misogyny in 1966? Okay, you could try to make that reading, but then I think, well, all right, let's see what else is on Aftermath, shall we? Let's have a look what else is on Aftermath. Stupid girl. I'm not talking about the kind of clothes she wears. Look at that stupid girl. I'm not talking about the way she combs her hair. Look at that stupid girl. The way she powders her nose, her vanity shows and it shows. She's the worst thing in this world. Look at that stupid girl. I'm not talking about the way she digs for gold. Look at that stupid girl. Well, I'm talking about the way she grabs and holds. Look at that stupid girl. The way she talks about someone else that she don't even know herself. She's the thickest thing in the world. Look at that stupid girl. Okay. Shall we have a look at some more tracks on Aftermath? See where we're going here. Is Mother's Little Helper. What a drag, it's getting old. Kids are different today, I hear every mother say. Mother needs something today to calm her down. Though she's not really ill, there's a yellow little pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day. One of the things that I think a lot of these songs on Aftermath are about Jagger and Richards are not talking about misogyny in these songs. And they're not really being, I mean, I'm sure a feminist would say, oh, yes, this is just the awful misogyny of the mid-60s of, you know, these patriarchal figures of the Rolling Stones. But I would say that all they're really doing is they're talking about the eternal power struggles between men and women in relationships, going all the way back to Taming of the Shrew and, you know, the... something like Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, where it's, you know, there's a struggle. There's always a power struggle between the man and the woman in the relationship. And, you know, in a song like Under My Thumb, he's resentful of the fact that she had the upper hand for a while, and now he's bringing it down. And this is just like normal. It's not, there's nothing political about it, is the point I'm making. These are just songs about men and women. You know, from some young men in the 60s, it's not respect. It's just like, yeah, you know, you're gonna have to behave and feel my hand sometimes. So, yes, I just thought I would use the Rolling Stones to demonstrate that even in the kind of gender dynamics and the sexual dynamics, I don't think these guys were revolutionary in any single way. This is just like old fashioned, you know. Yes, there's power in relationships. And some, you know, if you're going to be with me, it's going to have to be my way or the highway, love. All right, let's carry on. Now, another group, the Kinks, probably the best example, I would say, of... a group that's always looking backwards. And this is a group I've talked about before, the Kinks, the album Arthur, or The Decline and Fall of the British Empire. And again, this is the Kinks dealing with what it meant to kind of grow up in Britain in the aftermath of World War II. Now, it's a concept album, and there is this character, Arthur, that they're exploring these themes with. But again, you know, bear in mind now, this is 1969. They're not talking about Stonewall. They're not talking about gay rights. They're not talking about, you know, black people and civil rights. They're talking about, well, let's see what they say. Well, Mr. Churchill says, we've got to fight the bloody battle to the very end. Mr. Beaverbrook says, we've got to save our tin and all the garden gates, and empty cans are going to make us win. We shall defend our island on the land and on the sea. We shall fight them on the beaches, on the hills and in the field. We shall fight them in the streets. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed to so few. These are all Churchill quotes, of course. Because they have made our British Empire a better place for you and me, and this was their finest hour. Well, Mr. Montgomery says, and Mr. Mountbatten says, we've got to fight the bloody battle to the very end. As Vera Lynn would say, we'll meet again someday. But all the sacrifices we must make before the end. Did you hear that plane flying overhead? There's a house on fire and there's someone lying ahead. We got to clean up the streets and get me back on my feet because we want to be free. Do our worst and we'll do our best. We got to win the way that Mr. Churchill says. Oh. Well, Mr. Churchill says we got to hold up our chins. We got to show some courage and some discipline. We got to black up the windows and nail up the doors and keep right on till the end of the war. Now, this is a very interesting song to me. In fact, the whole album is very interesting because while the Kinks are, of course, in some ways immortalizing the sacrifices made by people for Mr. Churchill and so on, there's another much more ambiguous level that you can take a song like this, which is like, well, at the end of the day, was it worth it? You know, we did all of this stuff for Mr. Churchill and for the Empire and so on, but where's it got us, really? I mean, there's a sense in which on Arthur in 1969, they're saying, like, hold on, I mean, the Empire's gone. You know, life is becoming increasingly, like, dominated by, you know, America and all the other sorts of nonsense, the plastic men, you know, they talk about the plastic man. So I do think that there's a, I mean, it's obviously the Kinks in 1969 aren't going to come out and write an anti-Churchill song, but there's a set, there is a, you know, in the fact that they're calling them Mr. Montgomery, Mr. Mountbatten, Mr. Churchill, Mr. Beaverbrook, there is a distancing tool whereby Ray Davies is not quite prepared to say, like, well, this was a great thing. And again, there's that residual feeling of the angry young men, like, hold on, have they actually sold us down the river here? And again, this is something the country, something of Britain is still, even now, not come to terms with fully, which is the fact that World War II was devastating for the country. Let me carry on. But again, this is not a song about revolution, is it? This is looking back. This is a band in 1969 thinking back to the moment of World War II and Vera Lynn. Can you imagine Buffalo Springfield mentioning Vera Lynn in a song? So let's carry on. Here's from the same album, Nothing to Say by the Kinks. Remember walking with you by my side. You're my papa and I was your pride. And now I got children and I'm going grey. No time for talking. I got nothing to say. Those Sunday dinners that we had at home. Now I got a house and I got friends of my own. We can't do tomorrow what we did yesterday. It's best that we're going our separate ways, okay? How is your rheumatism? How are your chill beans? How's Auntie Mabel? Nothing to say. So far, Papa, I got nothing to say, okay? Those happy days we spent together, we thought our world would never change. And the days go by, and things will never be the same. You keep pretending that everything's fine, so you make small talk to help pass the time. But all the words that you spit from your face add up to nothing. You got nothing to say. How are your noisy neighbours next door? I have to go soon because I'm getting bored. I got to be home early to see a good play. So far, Papa, I got nothing to say. How's your life insurance? Nothing to say. How's your trade union? Nothing to say. How's your independence? Nothing to say. So far, Papa, I got nothing to say. And again, there's a very strong British sense of the mundane in this song. It's a song about some of the kind of existential meaninglessness of modern life, you know, all of these kind of bits of small talk. And but there are also deeply nostalgic themes in here. And again, let's consider this verse again and ask ourselves, are these the words of revolutionaries? How do these compare with the times they are changing? Those happy days we spent together, we thought our world would never change. How the days go by and things will never be the same. This is the words of a group of young men who feel that something is being lost that they'll never be able to recover. This is not embracing modernity with two hands and being like, yes, revolution is coming. This is being aware that something is being lost in this process. That the life is being sucked out of the country. Let's carry on. Dirty old river, must you keep rolling, flowing into the night. Busy, so people so busy, make me feel dizzy. Taxi lights shine so bright. But I don't need no friends. Long as I gaze on Waterloo sunset, I'm in paradise. Every day I look at the world from my window. Chilly chilly is the evening time. Waterloo sunset's fine. Terry meets Julie, Waterloo station, every Friday night. But I am so lazy, don't want to wander. I stay at home at night. But I don't feel afraid. As long as I gaze on Waterloo sunset, I'm in paradise. Millions of people swarming like flies round Waterloo underground. But Terry and Julie cross over the river where they feel safe and sound. And they don't need no friends as long as they gaze on Waterloo sunset. There in Paradise. Again, now all of these songs by the Kinks, as like the Beatles songs, are drenched with a sound of nostalgia. They're looking back. And this song here, obviously Waterloo, is not just the name of a station, but of a famous battle as well. It's got, you know, the front cover's got the Union Jack on it. And this is a song that is rooted in a time, it's rooted in a place, and it even goes beyond that. There are a couple here, Terry and Julie. Obviously, Terry and Julie are two British people, right? They're two, you know, these are two normal people. And they get a sense of contentment and safety and belonging when they think about Waterloo Sunset. It's a song about home. It's a song about feeling safe because you're in good old Blighty. Again, a world away from something like Buffalo Springfield, for what it's worth. Just on a different planet in terms of its sensibilities, in terms of its politics. And again, I think this is a very interesting thing to consider. Imagine the American 60s didn't exist and this is all we had. Would we think of the 60s in the same way? Let's carry on. Here's another Kinks song. This is from 1965, a little bit earlier. Well-respected man. So there is a bit of social commentary here. I'm not saying that these guys, you know, thought that everything was hunky-dory. But let's just see how they talk about it. Because he gets up in the morning and he goes to work at 9 and he comes back home at 5:30, gets the same train every day because his world is being built around punctuality. It never fails. But he's oh so good. He's oh so fine. He's oh so healthy in his body and his mind. He's a well-respected man about town doing the best thing so conservatively. And his mother goes to meetings while his father pulls the maid. And she stirs the tea with councillors while discussing foreign trade. And she passes looks as well as bills at every suave young man. Because he's oh so good, he's oh so fine, he's oh so healthy in his body and his mind. He's a well-respected man, about town, doing the best thing so conservatively. And he likes his own backyard and he likes his fags the best because he's better than the rest. And his own sweat smells the best. And he hopes to grab his father's loot when Parter passes on. Because he's oh so good, he's oh so fine, he's oh so healthy in his body and his mind. So you could say, well, and he plays at stocks and shares, and he goes to the regatta, and he adores the girl next door, because he's dying to get at her, and his mother knows the best about the matrimonial stakes, because he's oh so good, he's oh so fine, so healthy in his body and his mind, doing the best thing so conservatively. So you could say, well, you know, maybe there's a bit of politics in here, maybe there's a bit of class resentment from the Kinks against the well-respected man. But I also think that if you look at the please close that door. Come on. Thank you. I also think that sorry, I've lost my place now. I'm gonna have a sip of coffee a second. But I also think there's a sense in which the Kinks, the Beatles, and a lot of the other acts around this time, I've just picked the most famous ones. I could have picked many, many other, like the Zombies, for example, do this as well, is that there's a sense that they were like to capture different parts of life in these little vignettes. And there's a sense in which this commentary on the well-respected man going around town, yes, it's critical of this man, but it's not like saying, oh, this man is so awful that we need to kill him. This man is so awful that we need to make sure that he's stripped of all of his wealth and influence, that we need a revolution to deal with this guy. It's much closer to something like the camera of Dad's Army looking at a character like Captain Mannerin, who's a bit up himself. He's got a few like airs and graces. He's a bit kind of you know, he's a bit uptight. He's a bit pretentious. You know, he wants to be well-to-do. And there's this British sense in which that sort of self-importance needs to be punctured a little bit. And I think that is the sort of tradition that the Kinks are working in here. This is not this. Even the song like this is not saying, we need to basically tear society up from the roots and start again from ground zero. This is much closer to writing in the mode of like Oscar Wilde, for example. If you think of an Oscar Wilde play or some of Oscar Wilde's essays, Oscar Wilde was not trying to tear Victorian society apart and start again. He was just gently poking fun of certain elements of it, just gently registering these kind of characters that are a part of the social landscape. In much the same way that, I mean, even later on, an act like Blur, for example, when they look at like the story of a charmless man or Country House, or, you know, they're not saying that these people should be destroyed. They're just saying that, you know, look at some of the sorts of people that exist at the moment, you know, and there's a kind of, I think there's a British sense in which you can register these things in a way that is almost loving. If you think of something like Ricky Gervais's portrait of David Brent, you know, loathsome character, wanker in so many ways, a recognizable type from a, you know, low grade paper merchant office in Slough. And yet, I don't think Ricky Gervais wrote the character of David Brent with hatred in his heart. He's not saying that David Brent shouldn't exist. He's just registering this person and kind of gently poking fun, or sometimes mercilessly poking fun, you know, at the sort of, you know, the pretensions and the, you know, the foibles of a character like this. You know, there's a great grand British tradition of that, but it's not revolutionary. And it's not hateful. I'll just look at one last song in this mode from the Kinks, and then I'll have a look at the chat, take some questions maybe. Dedicated Follower of Fashion by the Kinks. This is from 1966 on the Kink Controversy. They seek him here, they seek him there, his clothes are loud but never square. It will make him or break him, so he's got to buy the best because he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds around the boutiques of London town, eagerly pursuing the latest fads and trends, because he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh, yes, he is. Oh, yes, he is. He thinks he is a flower to be looked at. And then he pulls his frilly nylon pants right up tight. He's a dedicated follower of fashion. Yes, he is. Yes, he is. One week he's in polka dots, and the next week he's in stripes, because he's a dedicated follower of fashion. They seek him here. They seek him there, in Regent Street and Leicester Square. Everywhere the Carnabician army marches on, each one a dedicated follower of fashion. This pleasure-seeking individual always looks his best because he's a dedicated follower of fashion. He flits from shop to shop just like a butterfly. In matters of the cloth, he is as fickle as can be because he's a dedicated follower of fashion. He's a dedicated follower of fashion. Now, I included this song so you could see that clearly now, the Kinks have turned their gaze, their little vignette, from the well-respected man, okay, or the, you know, the middle-class bourgeois, to now it's like a kind of, you know, somebody trying to be hip and happening in swinging London in 1966. And they're gently poking fun at this Austin Powers type figure who's, you know, trying to be all hip and with it. But again, it's not hateful. They're not saying the dedicated follower of fashion shouldn't exist, or that, you know, he's an abomination that must be destroyed. Just kind of observing life and saying, well, you know, this is the sort of creature that exists in 1966 in London. And it's funny. You know, it's faintly ridiculous that this person wears nylon pants and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the American, the British 60s, you know, people may say, well, I cherry picked here, but I just picked some of the most famous ones. You know, you couldn't say I picked any, I just picked iconic songs from an iconic act from Britain and America. We could have looked at other ones, but I struggle to think. I mean, the closest thing I could think of to something revolutionary from Britain at this time was The Who's My Generation. But even when you look at a song like My Generation, it doesn't really say anything. All it says is, like, we exist, basically. My generation exists. it doesn't say anything else. It's not saying, my generation's going to come and, like, destroy everything that you love. It's just like, yeah, people are mad because we exist, basically. So, and that's the closest I would say that any of these acts come to being, like, truly, quote-unquote, revolutionary. So anyway, that is my thesis. So ends my catechism. So ends my pontification on this subject. I'm going to have a look at some super chats, and I'm going to just have a look. I mean, if people have got questions in the north, you know, you don't have to super chat. Deepest North is never about money. It's always about the arts. It's always about culturally enriching discussions. Ian Inkster says, is sex on a Wednesday afternoon degenerate or aristocratic? Sex on a Wednesday afternoon. Why does it have to be either of those things? Why can't it just be normal? Harrison Wade says, yeah, I don't really get, I think it's a false dichotomy. I think plenty of people can have sex on a Wednesday afternoon, regardless of the time and the place, especially if they're married, of course. Harrison Wade says, £26 for my hair and beard to be event worthy. Well, I had my beard done alone. I didn't have my hair done. And just for my beard trim and the little hot towel and all that, I paid £18 just for the beard. So I would say £26 is under the par for this area. But it depends on where you are. I know my dad refuses to pay more than I think £5 for a haircut. So it really depends on where you are. Harrison Wade says, I don't believe husbands and wives necessarily have to like each other. Who said that then? I mean, I believe that. Is that something I said? Who's that quote from? Simeon Robin says, video request, resource-based economy. If you look up pictures of them, it's a fantasy land, like Star Trek examples of R-based economies are not glamorous. I'm a little bit lost there, Simeon. Aren't all economies resource-based? Economics is the study of scarce resources which have alternative uses. All economies are resource-based. It's just whether the state directs the resources or the market directs them, or a combination of both. So I don't really understand what resource-based economy means. Charles Eccle says, Whitsun Weddings by Philip Larkin is a perfect summation of Britain in the 50s. Degradation, loss of history, and creeping US materialism. I'll have a look at that, actually. I'll have a look at that. Wits and Weddings by Philip Larkin. Let's give it a little read, shall we? It's quite long, mind. Shall I read it? Let's read it, given that this is the deepest law. We can do readings of poems. Why not? Here's Whitsun Weddings, Philip Larkin. That Whitsun, I was late getting away, not till about 1:20 on the sunlit Saturday, did my three quarters empty train pull out, all windows down, all cushions hot, all sense of being in a hurry gone. We ran behind the backs of houses, crossed a street of blinding windscreens, smelt the fish dock, thence the river's level, drifting breadth again began, where sky and Lincolnshire and water meet. All afternoon, through the tall heat that slept for miles inland, a slow and stopping curve southwards we kept. Wide farms went by, short-shadowed cattle, and canals with floatings of industrial froth. A hothouse flashed uniquely, hedges dipped and rose, and now and then a smell of grass displaced the reek of buttoned carriage cloth until the next town, new and nondescript, approached with acres of dismantled cars. At first I didn't notice what a noise the weddings made. Each station that we stopped at, sun destroys the interests of what's happening in the shade. And down the long cool platforms, whoops and skirls, I took four porters larking with the males and went on reading. Once we started, though, we passed them, grinning and pomaded, girls in parodies of fashion, heels and veils, all posed irresolutely, watching us go. As if out on the end of an event, waving goodbye to something that survived it, struck, I leant more promptly out next time, more curiously, and saw it all again in different terms, the fathers with broad belts under their suits, and seamy foreheads, mothers loud and fat, an uncle shouting smut, and then the perms, the nylon gloves, and jewellery substitutes. Hold on a second. What's going on? Thanks a lot. You can tell this one. Hold on a second. This one's gone cold, unfortunately. Thanks a lot. All right. Sorry, I've been given a carrot cake and some coffee, which interrupted me. Okay, being called a diva yet again. Where was I? The nylon gloves and jewellery substitutes, the lemons, mauves and olive ochres that, marked off the girls, unreally from the rest, yes, from cafes and banquet halls up yards and bunting dressed, coach party annexes, the wedding days were coming to an end. All down the line, fresh couples climbed aboard. The rest stood round. The last confetti and advice were thrown. And as we moved, each face seemed to define just what it saw departing. Children frowned at something dull fathers had never known. Success so huge and wholly farcical, the women shared the secret like a happy funeral, while girls gripping their handbags tighter stared at a religious wounding. Free at last and loaded with the sum of all they knew, we hurried towards London, shuffling gouts of steam. Now fields were building plots and poplars cast long shadows over major roads, and for some 50 minutes, what in time would seem just long enough to settle hats and say, I nearly died, a dozen marriages got underway. They watched the landscape sitting side by side. An Odeon went past, a cooling tower, and someone running up to bowl, and none thought of the others they would never meet, or how their lives would all contain this hour. I thought of London spread out in the sun, and postal districts packed like squares of wheat. There we were aimed, and as we raced across bright knots of rail, past standing Pullmans, walls of blackened moss came close, and it was nearly done, this frail travelling coincidence, and what it held stood ready to be loosed with all the power that being changed can give. We slowed again, and as the tightened brakes took hold, there swelled a sense of falling, like an arrow shower sent out of sight somewhere, becoming rain. So that is The Wits and Weddings by Philip Larkin. And yes, I would agree that that has a real sense of kind of history being lost, the new world, the American world creeping in, And it's almost like a journey through time, isn't it? It's like the, as he's going through the stations, the echoes of the past are getting fainter. Kind of a haunting poem. Marcos 588 says, AA, a blue mink melting pot. Pull up those lyrics. Okay, so let's have a look at blue mink melting pot. So let's have a look. Lyrics. I am not familiar with the act Blue Mink. Who were they then? They were a British six-piece group who were around. They're around in the 1969 to the early 70s. Let's have a little look at Melting Pot then. Let's have a look at Melting Pot. Take a pinch of white man, wrap it up in black skin, add a touch of blue blood, and a little itty bit of red Indian boy. Curly Latin kinkies mixed with yellow. I can't even say that word. If you lump it all together, well, you've got a recipe for a get-along scene. Oh, what a beautiful dream. If it could only come true, you know. What we need is a great big melting pot, big enough to take the world and all it's got. Keep it stirring for 100 years or more. Turn out coffee-coloured people by the score. Rabbis and friars and bishops and gurus. You got Beatles or the sun god, but it doesn't really matter what religion you choose. Mick and Lady Faithful, Lord and Mrs. Graceful. You know the living could be tasteful. We should all get together in a loving machine. I'd better call up the Queen. It's only fair that she knows. You know. So there we go. Yes. What does this person say? I almost didn't add this. Read on. In 1969 and on into the 70s, it was upheld as an anthem to racial harmony. Revisiting it in 2013, it shocked me that it is an anthem to the ingrained racist language of the time. Maybe the lovely Madame Bell would like to re-record it for our time. So, yes, obviously some wanker was trying to annotate it on genius.com. Yes, it almost sounds like a parody to me. I mean, I wouldn't know what, wouldn't like to guess what Blue Mink's purposes were in writing that song. Let's have a look at some others. Tuesday, FA Tuesday says, AA, you should do a deeper store on Family Guy. That would be tremendous. Yeah, that would involve me actually watching Family Guy, Tuesday FA. I'm a man of culture and taste. Family Guy? You've got to be fucking kidding me. Somebody would really need to sell me on watching something as brain dead as Family Guy. I mean, to me, the best commentary on Family Guy was by South Park, wasn't it? Do you remember that episode where they had manatees randomly choosing joke, like writing Family Guy jokes? I don't miss it. Mrs. AA likes Family Guy, you know, and I'm very contemptuous of that. Whenever I see her watching it, I'm like, yeah, about your level, I say. Rowley 1001 says, review the Beatles Revolution. Okay. Let's have a look at Revolution by the Beatles. This is from the White Album, isn't it? Let's have a look at Revolution by the Beatles. I feel like it would be not a good use of our time to look at something as trite as Family Guy on the deepest law. Anyway, the Revolution by the Beatles. You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's going to be all right, all right, all right? You say you've got a real solution. Well, you know, we'd all love to see a plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we're doing what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. Don't you know it's going to be all right, all right, all right? You say you'll change the constitution. Well, you know, we all want to change your head. You tell me it's the institution. Well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying around pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't going to make it with anyone anyhow. Well, you know, it's going to be all right, all right, all right, all right, all right, all right. So, I mean, again, this doesn't really change anything, does it? This speaks to me of a deep skepticism in the Beatles of all of that kind of revolution stuff that they're typically associated with. But, I mean, it couldn't be. They basically say, like, if you're carrying around pictures of Chairman Mao, it's not got nothing to do with us. You know, the change that you want to make should be to yourself, not to the Constitution or the institution or, you know. So, I don't really see revolution as a revolutionary anthem. It says here, John Lennon expressing doubt in regard to some of the tactics used by the 1968 protests. Pretty obvious that when it comes to the British acts of the 60s counterculture, they were not capital R revolutionaries in that way. I'm not talking about, you know, some of John Lennon's personal antics later on and so on, but I just don't see it. And, you know, I think revolution basically confirms what I've been saying for all of this stream. Let's have a look at some more super chats, and then I will actually delve for once into the normal chat, because I want to see what people are saying about this. Rowley101 says, takes jabs at USA communist revolution. Yes, you're absolutely right there, Rowley. It's obvious that, you know, they're not that kind of hard left and never were. Mark Antonio says, to what extent did market forces, differing audiences, shape the popularity of these acts, do you think? These were acts that sold, but there were fewer records to choose from. Controlled selection? There were certainly not fewer records to choose from. Go back and watch my 100 albums by 100 artists, or some of my AA radios if you haven't seen them. There were hundreds, thousands of acts in the 60s that you haven't heard of. There were not fewer records to choose from. That would be wrong to say that. The scene was absolutely, on both sides, in Britain and in America, it was a very, very healthy scene. Probably like the 50th best psychedelic album of 1968 is probably better than the best record of last year, if I was to guess. You know, I gave people one for free, Begin by the Millennium. That's an album most people have never heard of, and it's better than, probably easily better than anything that's come out this year. I can say that without even looking it up. It would be wrong to say that there were fewer records. I do think that there was a difference in the British and American audiences, though. That much is obvious. But if you have a look at what sold, the British acts did sell in America. The Beatles were massive in America. Even the Kinks and the Stones and the Who sold records in America. The British invasion was real over there. An interesting exercise might be to have a look at the Billboard Top 100 for any given year or any given month, and then have a look at the UK Top 40 in the same period. You'll see that some songs didn't make it in Britain that made it in America, and vice versa. But on the whole, I would say that more British acts made it over in America than vice versa, if I was to just make a guess, and that's just based on my own kind of interest in this period and in the music. But I feel like there was more British exports over there than there were American acts coming here. That's not to say that there wasn't American influence. I mean, one of the obvious things is that almost all British acts sung with an American accent. Look at Tom Jones. Tom Jones was from the Valleys, and he sung like he was a Las Vegas singer. Still does. So I'm not saying there wasn't American influence here. There was American influence everywhere. I'm just saying that there were a lot of big hits in America that weren't hits here, and vice versa. There were songs that were big hits here that never made it over there. I don't know if Cliff Richard, for example, like Cliff Richard would be an example of a guy who probably had loads of UK number ones but never made it over in America. In fact, I think Devil Woman is his only American hit. You'd have to double check that, but yeah. So there's definitely difference. There's divergence between the two charts, without doubt. So yeah, they had. I mean, if I was to make some generalizations about differences of British and American tastes, American charts had a lot more R&B hits, a lot more soul, and stuff like that. British. And in the early 60s, there's a lot more, really cheesy, like American bubblegum pop over there. You know, like My Girl Lollipop and all this sort of stuff. How much is that doggy in the window? Now, you'd have to double check to see if those records sold over here in such big numbers. Whereas in this country... there's more of a trying to like, it's almost like rockier, kind of rockier in a way, more like rock and roll. And then we had like people like Cilla Black and, you know, those sorts of Phil Spector Wall of Sound artists. I don't know if Cilla Black sold records in America or not. Maybe she did. Yeah, if I had to pinpoint differences, it would be there's more of like a kind of black R&B soul thing going on, Motown records and things like that. Whereas I'm not sure if they sold in the volume in this country. Trying to think of the sorts of things that you had here. There's a lot of like novelty songs, British novelty songs that nobody even thinks of, like, Granddad by Arthur Lowe and stuff like that, you know, kind of George Formby revival act and stuff like that. You know, these things were in the charts. Nobody remembers them. So there's definitely more divergence between the British and American charts than people imagine, because everything's a lot more homogenous now. Like, I imagine in any given week, the same sorts of shite is in the top 10 in Britain and America. And, you know, it's just all music that sounds the same to me now. It's just some bimp with a vocalizer. Let's carry on. Have a look at Entropy, and then I'm going to have a look at some normal chat as well, because I really want to see people's thoughts on this topic. Yiz says, I spent 20 quid on a host of funny paid Entropy messages for UO, and you read none of them because of your new rules. It made me really angry, but I got over it. Good analysis today. Great solo stream. Well, Yiz, I mean, you're going to be the star of the overflow chat whenever I get to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it tonight because I'm going for a meal that's been pushed back 3 times. Me and Mrs. A are meant to be going for our anniversary meal. It was meant to be a month ago. I had to push it back once because of a funeral. Then they cancelled because of COVID. Then we got ill. So now we're finally doing it like a month later. So, but at some point, and then I'm going to the event, of course, tomorrow. So I'm going to be away all weekend. So probably no cigar stream tomorrow night. But at some point, maybe on Sunday night, I'm going to do Super Chat Overflow. And Yiz will have all of her messages read on that. So plenty of Super Chat action to come. Adam E says, my intro to your channel was your kink stream. Music today is so baseless and formulaic. It's time for a cultural reaction. Work by Jason Aldean and Tom McDonald consistently chart well. Muse, my favorite band, often features Orwellian themes. Yeah, I mean... I would never say that there's not good stuff around. There is good stuff around. It just doesn't chart these days. You know, I'm not one of these people who says, oh, you know, music was so much better in the 1960s than it is now. That's never the case. There's great records in every single decade, from the 1920s right through to now. Every decade has got amazing albums and amazing songs recorded. It's just a case of finding them. And now I would say the mainstream culture is hopeless, basically. I mean, occasionally you get a good song that comes out. I mean, this will probably make people cringe, but I think Adele is quite a good mainstream artist. I mean, she has got some good songs. There was one song she had. I mean, when I was going through my divorce, she had that song, Hello, where she picking up. Whenever that came on the radio, I would start crying because it seemed to hit something real while going through a breakup. So, you know, Adele's pretty popular and she's quite good, I guess. Trying to think of like decent. There's a guy called George Ezra who has a couple of good songs that I've seen. But you're right, they tend to be few and far between, and it tends to be that it's just buried under this horrible wall of like vocal effects, and everybody sounds a bit like kind of a bit like late Britney Spears to me whenever I hear anyone now. You know, there was this guy called Frank Ocean a few years ago who was fairly mainstream, but most of the good music is just unheard. Like, most of the good stuff now just doesn't chart. It's just not well known, but it is around. So have a look on AA Radio. I feature good acts on there all the time. Yiz the eunuch says, McCarthy was subverted and shut down before he discovered what George Lincoln Rockwell discovered. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I think looking back, it's obvious that George McCarthy was just like just another guy who thought the GOP was a real thing and ended up getting himself outflanked by the establishment. So, all right, so let's have a look at the normal chat then, see what people are saying. Yeah, it's auto-tune. That's the thing I was looking for, auto-tune. God, it's awful. Yeah. Fishy Frenzy says, thoughts on the Smiths, specifically songs such as This Charming Man. Yeah, I mean, I think the Smiths are phenomenal, quintessentially British act, and in many ways the heirs to the Kinks. I mean, I think there's quite a nice through line, you know, from the Kinks to the Smiths to people like Blur and various others, but the Smiths definitely have a strong sense of the same thing. And again, I think there are reactionary themes right through the Smiths, right through Morrissey's lyrics. Everybody thought he was a lefty because he was a vegan, he was a vegetarian and all that sort of stuff. And he was a bit of a ponce, but I think Morrissey was, you know, probably based and red-pilled. Not kind of overtly, not in his politics. If you asked him, he probably said, yeah, okay, I hate the Tories and I'm going to vote Labour, but who cares about that sort of stuff? His soul is romantic, capital R romantic, and ultimately reactionary. I would say the same for Ray Davies. I think ultimately I'm just talking about where their bread is buttered, ultimately, where they're coming from. And I think their instinct is to look to the past. And to be rooted in a place, to not be talking about abstract ideals like the American artists are always talking about abstract ideals or like what it means to be black and all this bollocks, whereas I just can't imagine any of these British writers speaking in that way. And I'm not saying that as a kind of patriot or nationalist. I'm just saying, like, this is what I see in the music, you know. There are amazing American artists, by the way, who speak to something much deeper. you know, we've talked about Johnny Cash. I mean, Johnny Cash was around in the 1960s. I mean, you know, Johnny Cash is probably due a deepest law all on his own, but, you know, people think of things like At San Quentin, right, or you know, at Folsom Prison. Those records are not what people think they are. People think of, Johnny Cash, you know, he's going down there and probably he's like for criminal rights. No, he wasn't. There's a hardcore Calvinist, like, you cannot get redemption on this earth in Johnny Cash. You know, he's playing with thieves and murderers and rapists, but he's looking at them and saying, like, it's for God to judge you ultimately, and you know where you're going. It's hardcore, old school religion in Johnny Cash, which is absolutely nothing to do with the 60s counterculture in the way that people think of it. You know, the later 60s Bob Dylan is rooted in true Americana as well, in the same way, I would say. There are lots of great American acts who have nothing to do with the kind of abstract ideals I was talking about, but I'm talking about what the counterculture meant, you know. The Smiths, very good. Let's have a look what else people are saying. Can you do a stream about the international American effect of black hip-hop gangsterhood music and its negative effect on society around the world beginning from the late 80s? I mean, maybe I could think about that. I do think that rap had a negative effect on the casualization of society. The idea of like young people wearing like baggy pants and tracksuits and thinking that's all right, you know. Let's have a look what else people are saying. I mean, people talk about it. I think Johnny Cash, if you look at his lyrics and his through line, was like a kind of hardcore old school Southern Calvinist or something like that. It's like there's nothing you can do. God is going to cut you down. And that gives him a kind of extremism that I find exciting. So I genuinely think Johnny Cash is a, you know, he's a top five, top 10 artist when it comes to music for that and that alone. He's just a beast from a different world. I mean, when it comes to hip hop, I have my own rather idiosyncratic views about hip hop, because in a way that is its own extreme countercultural space as well. One of the lenses that I like to see hip hop through is that it's an incredibly masculine kind of space in a very, very feminine world. You know, and pro wrestling is like that as well. You know, in pro wrestling, the answer to everything is let's have a fight. And in rap, there's a lot of kind of bravado and one-upmanship and what it means to be a man kind of hidden in there. Well, it's not so hidden in there. It's pretty upfront. Now, I'm not saying that rap is a force of good or it's based or anything like that, but I'm just saying that it does register this kind of unapologetic, you know, masculine energy. Yes, there's a kind of low IQ, you know, all of the things associated, all of the things people associated with are true, but I find that hip hop registers something visceral that is lacking in other forms of music, and that to see it purely in terms of cultural degradation is you know, is, I know that's an unpopular view in these spheres, but I stick to it. Let's have a look. I mean, I do see the thing is, people are saying, well, it's corporate dirge and all of this, but a lot of proper hip hop is probably is kind of defiantly anti-commercial. In fact, they rage a lot against, music executives who are almost invariably Jewish, of course. I don't know. I think that there's something in rap culture and in the black community in America at its core that is on the same side as us. I know people will not agree with me, but I think, dig a little bit deeper, and some of those black nationalists, the Malcolm X types, they understand the globo homo is their enemy as much as anyone else. And have a look at where they direct the anger a lot of the time. So, yeah, again, I'm not going to say hip hop is based or anything like this. I'm just saying that it registers things that aren't allowed to be registered anywhere else. So I don't write off any art form, even fucking jazz has got things to offer. Wu-Tang, for example, managed to carve out a space without being in hock to the big music companies. They made their own label. And you get a lot of rap acts who make their own label, and they make their name in their own communities, in the hood, and somehow, occasionally, it breaks through. So, I don't know, like any other form, there's good and bad stuff. You know, 99% of rap is shite, but that's true of everything. 99% of rock is shite. Most punk is shite. So it just what you're looking for, basically. And I understand that people's minds are closed to these sorts of things, but I don't care, to be honest. There we go. I mean, people saying not a single instrument played, but the art of, there's an art to the sample. There's an art to the drum machine, putting those things together. It's its own form, you know. Most Aphex Twin albums don't have an instrument played on them either. So I don't know what, don't really know why that cares, why that matters. I find it interesting when I put some of my playlists together, and it's like, when it's Johnny Cash singing about killing a man, that's cool. But if it's 50 Cent, all of a sudden it's degenerate. You know, there's a lot of this stuff. Or if it's, The Fall singing about like drugs or drinking, it's cool. But if it's a rap act, all of a sudden it's degenerate. You know, I just don't understand that. So I just, when it comes to these things, I don't argue with people. I just, people like what they like. I mean, I've never been a big fan of country, to be honest. Like, country's not one of my favorite genres. But I wouldn't try to be disrespectful to people who like country. You know, people like what they like. Iron Duke says, check out the English band Squeeze, not especially left wing. I'm from South London. Yeah, I love a bit of Squeeze. You know, Jules Holland and... I actually wanted to include a Squeeze song on the last AA radio, but it was blocked, unfortunately. I wanted to include, they've got a really cool like pub rock song that's sung by, I forget their names now, but there's a guy who usually sings all the Squeeze songs, but then like the main kind of guy who writes the music comes in just for this one song. It's called... what's it called? It's called Cool for Cats. Cool for Cats by Squeeze from 1978. And that's a pretty cool, like, Ian Dury style pub rock song by Squeeze. I think Squeeze have probably got one of the best greatest hits of any act. You know, they're just there, just their singles, the one CD greatest hits. Phenomenal. Great singles act, great new wave act as well. I played Pulling Muscles on one. Somebody saying Beastie Boys, Ill Communication or Paul's Boutique. Well, because I'm cool, I'll go for Paul's Boutique. That's the correct answer. yeah, Jesus and Mary Chain. I mean, they're a bit fuzzy for me, Jesus and Mary Chain, but yeah, they're good. They're good. Zappa, I like. Thoughts on Kanye West? I mean, Kanye West is probably the best producer of the past 20 years. I mean, that's not a controversial view. Unique sound, very soulful. All his albums are good. I haven't listened to the more recent ones. Kanye West is great. I got nothing bad to say about Kanye. It's just good. Warren Zevon is good. Clapton did not make an appearance on the 100 albums. I'm not that. I mean, obviously, I've got my Cream albums and a bit of Clapton and so on, but I've never been that keen on, like, kind of when things get like a very kind of boomery dad rock like that. I mean, I don't like the phrase dad rock, to be honest. I find it, you know, generally unhelpful, but there's something about, like, when it starts getting to like Clapton and stuff like that, I'm just like, yeah. Probably my favorite stuff from Clapton. I like my Delta Blues. Clapton is a really big blues head. And I've got a few like acoustic Clapton albums where he's just like exploring old blues songs and things. That's probably the best Clapton stuff I can remember. I can't remember the names of those albums now, but I like Clapton when he's just kind of alone with an acoustic guitar doing blues, to be honest. Benjamin Proud says, very proud of you and your moral clarity and willingness to fight online at the moment. Well, thank you very much, Benjamin Rood. Ian Duke says, Pink Floyd, The Clash. Yeah, I mean, Pink Floyd, I mean, Prague and what happens in the 70s then is a different stream, really. But I think I was talking to Morgoth or someone, I think it was Morgoth, because since I've gone on Telegram, I can do my lovely DM conversations with people again, since they've all been bloody banned off Twitter. I was talking about my theory about Prague, where essentially what happened is that I think white Anglo artists like Pink Floyd, like Jethro Tull, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, it doesn't matter what the Prague Act was, but let's just stick with Pink Floyd a minute. I think what was happening there is that they were rediscovering classical forms, inherently European forms, white forms, within what is ostensibly a black form, which is, you know, blues-based rock and roll. If you listen to Rolling Stones very much don't do that. They stay very much within the blues rock structure, and they are self-consciously, you know, if you listen to something like Exile on Main Street, they are self-consciously playing in the tradition of Robert Johnson, who's a black man, yeah? Whereas I think over on the Beatles side of things, Paul McCartney is constantly rediscovering classical European forms within kind of an ostensibly black form rock and roll. And I think Pink Floyd carry on doing that sort of thing. And I think that the prog rock movement, in a sense, without, I don't know if they were aware of it or not, but there's something, I don't want to call it reactionary, because I'm not sure if any of them were political in that way, but they are definitely, doing something revivalist. You know, they are doing something that's harking back to a different tradition. You know, it's very overt when it comes to a Jethro Tull. But I think Pink Floyd have it as well. I think Pink Floyd have it right through their music. And we were talking about nostalgia and being rooted in the past and things. I mean, an album like Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd is drenched in nostalgia. It's drenched in the past. Even on their weakest material, like The Wall, it's drenched in like, you know, when was The Wall recorded? Like 1979? That's obviously harking back to like 20 years beforehand, though. You know, the old-fashioned school teacher with the mortarboard and the cane and so on. I mean, I think Pink Floyd are as backwards-looking as they are forwards-looking, the same as a lot of the 60s acts. Let's see what else people are saying here. I think a couple more super chats came in as well. Adam E says thoughts on the Clash. I mean, there's nothing wrong. Somebody's just said something about Family. It says Simeon Roban says One Piece are way better than the Family Guy. Check it out. Okay. I can't promise anything, but maybe. Adam E says thoughts on the Clash. I got nothing against the Clash. Obviously, I've got all their essential albums. My last AA radio was about boredom, I listened to quite a lot of punk recently and was coming back to punk. And even in punk, I saw a marked difference between the American acts and the British acts. The American acts, how can I say, it's a lot more like druggy and nihilistic and kind of coked out, the American punk scene, whether it's that Detroit scene or the Ramones, or, you know, it's a lot more overtly nihilistic, I think. Whereas the British punk scene is kind of spiky. And it's kind of, I think it, and again, don't get me wrong, there are some properly oiky, bloody left-wing anarchist twat groups. I mean, I played a record by a Crass on AA radio, and obviously they would be Antifa today, those guys. But I think like the Sex Pistols, the Clash, and various other British punk groups of that era, they've got a hint of that angry young man as well. The angry young man who is, you know, only this time it's there in the late 70s. Let's face it, Britain in the 70s was a shithole. It was a shithole. And they were pissed off. They were rightly pissed off about what was happening to their country. And, you know, yes, anarchy in the UK, blah, blah. But dig underneath it a little bit. And I think there are, again, capital R romantic / reactionary kind of undercurrents, even in the Clash and the Sex Pistols. Even in the Clash, there are those strains. Now, people will say I'm mad here, but it's just in the animating spirit of what it means to be an Anglo. They're not going to produce anything else because it's not in the Brit. It's not in the Brit to be like a French revolutionary. It comes out in America because America's got loads of Jews there who love revolution. But these guys aren't Jews. I don't think that's controversial to say that. It's just a different sensibility. And even in punk, it comes through. Even in something like punk. Okay, let's have a look what else we've got. 99 Duke says The Verve. I always thought they were much better than Oasis, who I never liked. Oh, I mean, the I mean, obviously, I was around then. I remember writing a review of the Verve. What was that album they had? The one every 1997 had a Bittersweet Symphony on it. I remember writing a review of it in the school magazine. I reviewed loads of albums that year. I kind of became like the music reviewer for our school magazine. And the Verve were kind of, you know, they were right. They were a bit depressing, I reckon. I was thinking about this as well. We were talking about the difference between Britain and America. When I've been looking for music from the 90s, it's hit me between the eyes, really, that America, like I've got an episode about losers coming up. It's, the theme is losers. And in America, it, just through the music now, the pop culture in America, it was either like really depressing, nihilistic, kind of existential void, like Nirvana kind of, you know, where you end up with Kurt Cobain literally killing himself. Or it's like kind of like, oh, I'm a wiener and I've been bullied. And, you know, it's like kind of like this kind of college, like Ben Folds Five kind of wiener college rock, kind of whiny, just kind of fucking losers, basically. There's tons of it in America in the 90s. Losers and depressives and, you know, and there's that's a dominant theme in American 90s culture. Over here, you say what you want about Oasis and Blur and Verve and, you know, whatever else was going on. I think the vibe in Britain in the 90s was upbeat. And this precedes Tony Blair, who just kind of managed to hitch his wagon to it. There's something upbeat in the Britpop. There's something like of a rediscovery of being proud of what it means to be British. Like you could say, well, this was astroturfed, or this was kind of a nonsense version of a nonsense version of patriotism. But I mean, I remember David Bowie bringing out Earthling. You know, the front cover of Earthling. Let me just show you a Bowie Earthling. I remember these things being huge when I was a teenager, and being proud of it. Being proud, like these are our boys. This is, you know, this is a British hero, and he's appearing on the front of his album with a Union Jack. The Union Jack was everywhere when we were teenagers. You know, like you can say what you want about Oasis and Blur, but they were like happy and they were plugging into British traditions, their own heritage, which for them was Beatles and Kinks and, you know, the British invasion stuff and the Who and so on. But still it was British and they were proud of it. And we were proud of it. You know, and it, I mean, these things sound stupid, like Ginger Spice wearing the Union Jack and all of this sort of stuff. But it's a very different, if you go back and look at it now, the vibe between the British 90s and the American 90s is huge. Even when you go to some of the subcultures, like I've played quite a few Prodigy songs on AA Radio, or, you know, Fatboy Slim or Big Beat or any of this sort of stuff. And again, that scene in this country was kind of upbeat. It wasn't downer music. It was kind of like, you know, it was kind of an upswing, if that makes any sense. Whereas in America, I feel like the mood was going the other way for some reason. And I don't know why that, I haven't put my finger on why that is. I mean, again, I could be overselling this. But, you know, people are saying in, I mean, I'm not talking about the quality of the music. People are saying, oh, American alternative music pissed all over Britpop. I'm not talking about the quality of the music. You know, you can argue, oh, yes, Nevermind was a better record than, yeah, What's the Story, Morning Glory or whatever. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, where was the mood in the two places. And the mood registered in American music is not confident. It's downbeat. It's like a country that's lost its moral compass. Whereas the mood in the British music is a country finding itself again and getting over all of that stuff that the Kinks were talking about, getting over the fact that we lost the empire and just kind of coming to grips with who we are now in the late 20th century. And I can't remember who I was talking to about this, but I feel like a lot of that changed very rapidly in the past few years. I think there were some last vestiges of it in the 2012 Olympics. I'm not saying the pause wasn't there. The pause is always there, and the pause was there in the 2012 Olympics as well. But you still saw the Union Jack everywhere, and you still had a sense of, like, I remember some of the stuff around then. A lot of the boomer icons were there. I mean, I remember Ray Davis played Waterloo Sunset, and there were the shots of the Parliament and the London Eye, the fucking abomination that they made. And that, I think, was the very last gasp of that kind of British patriotic revival that happened in the 90s there. It probably died earlier, but it was like the very last gasp were probably Ray Davis singing Waterloo Sunset in the closing ceremony. So yeah, no sniffle. I was just clearing my nose. Okay. Yes, the 2012 Olympics was the last drip that falls on the trouser leg. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's right. It's a very good way of putting it. I wouldn't over-egg how good 90s alt-rock was. There's a lot of fucking shite that came out of America in the 90s. Let's not get too carried away. I'm saying was is that there was a positivity in the zeitgeist of Britain in the 90s that was absent in America. There we go. I'm not going to about to cry. Fucking no, I'm not. All right. Anything else? Should we get out of here? Iron Duke has said, Adam E says, check out The Globalist by Muse if you have time. What the lyrics? Let's have a look at The Globalist by Muse. Muse were big for a while, weren't they? Don't know what they're doing at the minute, but I remember them being around quite a lot. Huh. Globalist by Muse. You were never truly loved. You have only been betrayed. You were never truly nurtured by the churches of the state. You were left unprotected to these wild and fragile lands, but you can rise up like a god, arm yourself. You can be strong. You can build a nuclear power, transform the earth to your desire, free your mind from false beliefs. You can be the commander in chief. You can hide your true motives to dismantle and destroy. You finally have the code. I have given you the code. There's no country left to love and cherish. It's gone. It's gone for good. It's you and me, babe, survivors to hunt and gather memories of the great nation we were. There's no countries left to fight and conquer. I think I destroyed them all. It's human nature. The greatest hunter will survive alone with no one left to love. There's no culture left to love and cherish. It's gone. You know, it's gone for good. A trillion memories lost in space and time forevermore. I just needed to be loved. Yeah, pretty interesting lyrics those from Muse. What album's that on then? Drones. Might have to check that out. So it's been a while since I listened to Muse. I had some of their earlier albums. Trying to remember their names now. What did I have? you know, because they've been around for a long time, haven't they? Yeah, you know, stuff like Plug In Baby, I remember. And yeah, just, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s stuff. And like, they kind of fell off my radar after that. So maybe I'll see what they've been up to in recent times. You know, I wouldn't be averse to playing a bit of Muse on a radio if they're not too funny about copyright. 99 Iron Duke says, check out a band called Forlorn. You can find them on YouTube. Okay, I'll check them out. Mr. Patriarch says, on Eurorock, reaching back to old forms, what about neoclassical metal in the 80s and even a bit in the 70s? Malmsteen, Rainbow, Scorpions B-sides. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a bit, there's always that tendency in metal, I think. I think there's, I mean, there's that kind of Viking-y element of metal, isn't there? Yeah, and it, in some ways you can see metal as being one of the kind of, one of the directions that came out of the milieu that produced, you know, prog was one side and metal was the other side, I think. Yes, certainly that those themes are there in, Land of Confusion Disturbed, somewhat reactionary. I'll have to check that out in my own time. Okay. Yes, I do have Origin of Symmetry. That is one of the ones I've got. Cool that you did the artwork there. Some of I'm always surprised by some of the people in my audience who've had like direct involvement with some of these acts. DRT is King says, metal is the only true grassroots music. It wasn't astroturfed by the big labels like punk, rap, and country. So there we go. All right. I think I will probably end it there. AAA is getting a bit more thingy. I'm just going to have a little bit of a look back through the chat here. I mean, another act I remember from the 90s was Suede. They had some interesting kind of songs when it came to this sort of theme. I remember they had one song called "There's a Great Big Crack in the Union Jack." Chris Leitch says, "Hey, will you do streams of the history of corporations?" Yeah, I think that's something I would return to. I think a history of JP Morgan would be really interesting to do. History of Ford Motor Company would be interesting, and possibly Walt Disney. Those would be the three that I would consider starting with. JP Morgan's a really interesting character. Let's just have a look back through. I can see Jonathan Poles in the chat. I'd love to know what he I know I get the impression that old Paul is into his music a little bit. I'd like to know what he makes of my analysis of American 60s versus British 60s in their historical and political context in this stream, if he goes back to listen to it, because people talking about Alice in Chains. Why do people say I'm crying? I was not bloody crying. I just wiped my nose. Fucking bell ends, a lot of you. Simon Robian says, my earlier super chat on resource-based economies, they're all resource-based, exactly. Even its name is a fallacy. It's a fantasy. Help, plebs. Debunk. Yeah, I still don't know what resource-based... Okay. Bowie had a feminine theme about him. That's cope, Britpop. So I wasn't talking about the quality of Britpop. Although I do think that Blur had plenty of good albums, and that the two main Oasis albums are still good. Pulp had good albums. Suede had some good albums. Even James had a good album. They all had at least one good album in them. It was a bit retrograde, Britpop, in many ways, but, you know. Noel Gallagher says that Live Forever was deliberately written to be positive as a juxtaposition to the American grunge scene. Well, that's very interesting. Oasis slagged off most American music. They particularly hated the Velvet Underground. Yeah, I mean, there is that song by Art Brute. I can't stand the sound of the Velvet Underground. Space Oddity is honestly next level. I mean, there'll obviously be a deeper score on David Bowie, but I know D really wants to do that with me, so I'll save that for me and D to do one day. I know far too much about David Bowie. I was obsessed with him when I was a teenager. And to the extent that when David Bowie died, I had texts from people I hadn't talked to for years asking me if I was all right. That's how much I was known to be a Bowie fan. So, and I was actually quite upset when he died, I'll be honest. I'll probably also be upset when Bob Dylan dies as well. I was also upset when Macho Man Randy Savage died. That was another, I'm not often affected by celebrity deaths and things like that, but Macho Man and David Bowie were the two that really affected me. 99 Iron Duke says, the band is Forlorn Hope. Check out the track Rifles. Okay, I'll check that out. Yes, Bowie died a few years ago. Of course, it was massive news as well when that happened. Stone Roses, yeah, they were good early kind of. You see, the thing is that it was called Britpop, but really it was a continuation of indie music, and it started with the Smiths. And you know, you could say, well, there was a big indie scene in the 80s, which then kind of, you know, eventually, you know, ended up as Britpop. But it was basically just continuation of what was going on then. So Supergrass had some good stuff. Do an Uncle Ted stream, you know, you want to? Yeah, why not? We could talk about Uncle Ted. Yes. Okay, I think we'll wrap up here. Hopefully this was a good stream, and people enjoyed it. People are saying Elvis is dead. Back is dead as well. Back is dead. All right, get out. Oh, I should remember as well. The coupon code summer25, the sale, you've got until the end of the month. There's still a few days left, and about a week left of my summer sale, but use the coupon code summer25. These sales do not come around very often. Probably your next chance will be Christmas, you know, so move while you can. Mr. Patriarch says, the cream rises to the top. R.I.P. Macho Man Randy Savage. Oh, yeah. All right, get out. And those of you who are going to the event, I'll see you tomorrow.